Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Workforce, Labor, Economic Development, and Finance and Policy Committee this morning. Today is March 10th, 2026, and we've got a full agenda today, members, and to the audience. I appreciate everybody being here today for some really important bills and conversation and updates. To give us kind of an overview of today, we're going to have House File 3545 up first. We've got a number of testifiers. And to the testifiers that are here today, thank you for coming in. Because we've got a lot going on today, we're going to limit you to about 2 minutes, kind of a hard stop at 2 minutes. And you'll see my committee legislative assistant, Noah, will raise up the green card to show you that there's 1 minute left. So you're halfway through. The red will be wrap it up. And I'll try not to interrupt you if I can, but just kind of let you know that we've got a tight schedule for that. Also, to those in the audience, and also there's a lot of submitted written testimony in your packet as well. So those folks that couldn't be here today, I want to make sure that we take a look at that. There's a lot of good information there, both in support of the bill and in concerns of the bill. So I want to make sure that we recognize that as well. Vice Chair Mecklen, we're going to start with approving the minutes from last week. Would you please give us your thoughts on that and make that motion, please?
Thank you, Chair Baker. March 5th, 2026 minutes, I would like to move to accept.
Any further questions on that, members? Seeing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes from March 5th, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Minutes are carried. Thank you, Representative Mecklen, for bringing the bill to us today. You are at the table. I would also just have you maybe start explaining your bill. I know that we have an amendment to the bill. And again, to keep things moving along, I'd like to have Ms. Peterson come up to the table if you could. And then Marcy Conrad, is it Nutt, I think, coming up to the table. And then I'm going to try to keep everybody kind of flowing into the seats if that's okay. So, Mr. Erickson, do you want to stay there for now? Are you on the? Are you testifying?
I am. Representative Mecklen did ask me.
Okay, good. That's fine. No problem at all. Yep, thank you. Sounds good. So with that, Representative Mecklen, to your bill, you want to move.
Thank you, Chair Baker. I would like to make a motion to move House File 3545 to the General Register. And I do actually have a DE amendment.
Please explain your amendment.
So the amendment, as it is to, it removes the authority for the commissioner to choose a more efficient standard. It removes the requirement for the 2038 Residential Energy Code to achieve the 70% reduction in annual net energy consumption compared to the 2006 Energy Use Index for Minnesota. The part of the idea behind this is a lot of conversations, but really comes down to home affordability. So, Mr. Chair, if we can move the DE.
Sounds good. Members, any questions for the author to get the bill in the shape he'd like to have it today? Nope. Seeing none, all those in favor to approve of the DE amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? As amended, House File 3545 is in front of us, members. Representative Mecklen, to your bill, as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as I was saying, like, where this really came from is when this passed a few years ago, the original bill, and then we started hearing how much this is going to add to the cost. And when you sit in the Housing Committee and all we talk about, Chair Igo and Chair Howard, is the lack of affordability of homes. And the simple fact that in 1 year, members, 1 year, the median age for a first-time home buyer went up by two, went from 38 to 40 years old. Many people in my age bracket, we all have bought, where many of us bought our first homes when we were in our early 20s, which is no longer feasible. And as we see more and more of this coming through, everything we do affects the cost of housing. And it's one of the most greatest wealth building tools we have as young people growing up. And all I see is, especially being in the trades, is it's becoming harder and harder to obtain that very tool to create wealth. So with that, I will move to all these testifiers, because we do have a few, and I know we're trying to be mindful of our time, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Mecklen. To that, again, I want to welcome Ms. Peterson to the table, and then on deck will be Marcy, if you would come and be ready to come in. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Angela Peterson. I'm the CODES Program Manager for Center for Energy and the Environment and an active participant in Minnesota's Energy Code development process. CEE is a nonprofit organization whose core mission is to develop and deploy effective energy solutions that strengthen the economy and improve the environment. I am here today to respectfully speak in opposition to House File 3545. Well, we understand that affordability is a key concern driving this discussion, and housing affordability is a significant challenge that we must address. Energy codes are not driving the rise in housing costs. In fact, Minnesota's residential energy code hasn't been updated since 2015, yet house prices have risen approximately 77% during that time, demonstrating that market actors outside of the energy code are driving the rise in housing costs. As we continue to face housing shortages in Minnesota, some have cited concerns about the impact of updated energy codes on housing starts. Recent research published by ACEEE found that new home construction in states adopting updated energy codes continued to track national housing trends, indicating that stronger codes do not slow down home building. Additionally, a home is not affordable if it is not affordable to live in. While many Minnesota homes are already being built to better than code efficiency standards due to market demand, energy codes ensure that all new homes become more affordable by locking in lower monthly utility bills for the first homeowner and every future occupant. When looking at the expected next residential energy code, a slipstream study found that energy efficiency upgrades would pay for themselves in utility savings in 5 to 9 years and save homeowners between $17,500 and $37,000 over 30 years, depending on which part of the state one lives in. Just 2 years ago, the legislator established clear direction for residential energy codes by mandating 3-year code cycles and setting long-term efficiency goals. That process is now underway with significant stakeholder participation from builders, industry experts, nonprofits, and state agencies. Reversing course now would disrupt that process and delay progress towards building homes that are more affordable for Minnesota families to own and live in. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Peterson, for showing everybody how this is done. Way to be on time. Thank you very much. All right, next up, and thank you for that. And we're going to save questions, members, till the end of all testifiers as well. Marcy, if you could come up, please introduce yourself and continue. And on deck is Mr. John Krenn. Please come forward and be ready to go. Thank you, and welcome, and introduce yourself.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Marcy Conrad Nutt. I'm an architect and member of the American Institute of Architects, Minnesota. I have practiced for 25 years and own my own firm that specializes in deep energy retrofits and new construction of homes. Because of AIA Minnesota's commitment to advancing building science and designing affordable homes for all, we must testify in opposition to this bill. Minnesotans understand the importance of investing in a good coat. One that is warm enough for our brutal winters, is airtight to keep out cold winds, yet permeable enough to let out moisture when needed. When applied to homes, these concepts become building science and can reduce energy use, protect structures from moisture damage, and add real-world comfort. Our code is currently on the path of moving from jacket to coat. But because current code is too often used as a ceiling rather than the floor that it is, Minnesotans can be shocked that their new code-built home is drafty and expensive to heat. They are given a jacket when they desire more than this. Minnesota's mixed climate of hot, humid summers and cold, brutal winters is difficult on our buildings and our occupants. We support the regular updating of energy code based on the latest IECC, but the climate zones are broad and change between those zones is small. It is imperative that local experts are allowed to weigh in. A specific example is that the latest 24 version allows 4 different walls to be built, notably the exact same options that are also available in Fayetteville, Arkansas. One option is a 2x6 wall filled with insulation and R5 continuous insulation. However, moisture models of that wall in our climate raise concerns that really should be at least an R10. We must have the ability for our state's experts to engage in healthy debate and make necessary adjustments. This bill would eliminate that ability, and we should not move backwards, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for your testimony today. Mr. Krenn, if you'd come forward, please, and then on deck is Jared Johnson. Mr. Krenn, welcome, and thank you, and please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is John Krenn. I'm a volunteer with the Sierra Club. I oppose House File 3545. We need to keep building homes that meet the latest standards for energy efficiency. We need to build with the future in mind, not the past. More efficient homes and buildings will cut our greenhouse gas emissions that are causing climate change and will save homeowners money. Climate change caused by fossil fuels is resulting in extreme weather events all over the planet. Those events are upsetting people's lives and costing hundreds of billions of dollars of damage, including major costs here in Minnesota. We know that's happening in Minnesota because the insurance companies are leaving Minnesota due to these severe weather events. And the insurance companies that remain are raising their premiums or putting restrictions on their Minnesota policies to limit payouts. Putting in the right insulation and other energy efficiency steps in a home or building is best done while the home is being built. I have put energy-related changes to my home, which is older, and it's more expensive, more time-consuming, more problematical than when you do it when the home is being built. New homes are going to be around for 100 years or more. It's just common sense to make them more energy efficient at the outset, which will save homeowners money as they pay for that energy. Minnesota is not like Texas or other states that have abundant fossil fuels. We lose money to other states or countries when we spend money on fossil fuels. By making our homes and buildings more energy efficient, Minnesota comes out ahead economically. Minnesota needs to continue to be a leader on this issue and others related to climate change. That leadership is more important now than ever.
Thank you, Mr. Kern, very much for your testimony. Next up is Jared Johnson. If you could come forward, and on deck would be Mr. Fowler. If you could be in the waiting wing on the on-deck circle, if you will. Mr. Johnson, welcome. Please proceed.
Thank you, committee members. Thanks for the opportunity to testify today. On behalf of Theus Alliance Minnesota, I want to express our opposition to HF 3545. We are a nonprofit volunteer organization representing architects, builders, and energy professionals who support high-performance building standards that improve housing affordability, comfort, and long-term energy savings. First, I just want to point out that energy codes and energy efficiency measures are not a primary contributor to housing unaffordability. It's often noted that Minnesota has some of the highest single-family home prices in the region. However, Minnesota has also had essentially the same residential energy code as Wisconsin and Iowa since 2015, while Illinois adopted a more efficient code in 2023 and still maintains a lower median home price than Minnesota. This suggests that high home prices do not correlate with stronger energy codes. Research consistently points instead to factors such as land costs, local land use regulations, high interest rates, and labor and material shortages as the primary drivers of housing prices. Second, I also wanted to point out that stronger energy codes do not result in reduced housing production. Several studies, including a 2025 multi-state analysis from the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy, show that construction levels generally remain consistent with national trends after new energy codes are adopted. And finally, repealing the current code acceleration process would discard years of stakeholder work and technical review conducted by the Department of Labor and Industry and its advisory groups. For anyone concerned about efficient governance and the responsible stewardship of public resources, such a move would represent a substantial waste of time and public resources already committed by the department and its partners. For these reasons, again, we urge the committee to reject HF 3545. Thank you for your time and consideration.
And thank you, Mr. Johnson, for your testimony today. Mr. Fowler, please come forward. And then Mr. Erickson will be on deck. Welcome to the table. Mr. Fowler, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you very much. Thanks to the co-chairs and the committee members. My name is Eric Fowler, he, him, his pronouns. I'm the director of building performance at Fresh Energy. We're a nonpartisan energy policy nonprofit that has engaged in energy codes since our founding. And I also served on the latest residential energy code technical advisory group at the Department of Labor and Industry. And we're opposing HF 3545 and the DE1, which would raise energy bills, increase grid strain, reduce safety and resilience, slow our climate progress, and restrict the department from writing the best codes for our state. I'll be brief to respect time, but I'm available to elaborate on any of this. So one, In 2024, this legislature made a promise to renters and owners of new homes. You will be comfortable and safe in your home without absurd energy bills, even during temperature extremes, and even if you lose power. The energy code doesn't just save money. It protects lives by reducing air pollution and by adding hours of safety in emergencies. In a winter power outage, indoor temperatures become unsafe below 40 degrees. A 2038 home can expect well over 100 hours of safety compared to under 50 with current code. Two, efficient homes are critical for energy affordability, and by reducing peak demand statewide, they also slow the need for expensive utility infrastructure upgrades as well. See the letter for more about cost effectiveness. The letter from Habitat of Itasca County recently affirms the cost effectiveness of a lot of these strategies. This bill would take away protections from residents everywhere. There was a letter that suggested the code doesn't apply everywhere. It exists to protect the public in all parts of the state, whether or not the local jurisdiction enforces. So at the risk of sounding like my dad, we need to keep the indoors in and the outdoors out. So let's shut the door on inefficient buildings. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fowler. Your dad would be proud of that. That's good. Thank you. And thanks for keeping on time. I appreciate that. I know you had a lot to say there. Mr. Erickson, please proceed. And then also Eric Boyd, if you would come up as our final testifier. And if there's anybody else in the audience, I may ask for that too quickly. But that's all we have signed up for today. So, Mr. Erickson, welcome. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Nick Erickson. I am the Senior Director of Housing Policy for Housing First Minnesota, and our mission is homeownership opportunities for all Minnesotans, and that's why I'm here today. Housing First also operates the state's largest green energy home building program, Minnesota's Green Path, which has seen to date roughly 50,000 homes tested and rated through our program here in Minnesota. On a personal note, I've sat through more than 300 hours of building code technical reviews in the last 2.5 years, so I have had to take in a lot of this over the years. Land use and zoning are testifiers right there. Land use and zoning are currently the number one challenge in housing. However, in the next decade, especially with the legislature addressing land use and zoning this session, we will see the energy code become the number one cost driver in Minnesota. Over the past few years, we've seen this discussion. It's been, you know, about what this next code does. But I'll be clear: this bill does not take away any protections, and it does not undo any work that has been done. This is about the 2038 standard. This is not about any technical review that's been done in past or recent years. This also does not stop future increases. Nothing here stops the state from adopting new energy codes going forward. In fact, this DE amendment from Representative Mecklen is a compromise to ensure that there is still new energy code adoption, but we are doing so with a homeownership-centric lens to make sure that it is affordable. Also wanted to point out that these energy codes don't actually increase housing affordability. Current mortgage lending products do not include utility payments. It is mortgage principal, interest, property taxes, insurance, and if you're in an HOA CIC setting, it would include those rates. By definition, increased construction costs decrease affordability, and energy codes do not increase housing affordability. Also, on the minimum code front, comments about, you know, only building to a minimum are false. Minnesota has a very robust utility rebate program. It is what's driving efficiency. We in Minnesota are building currently today about 20% beyond efficiency for new home construction beyond what the code requires. Getting rid of utility rebates will be what set us back, and this 2038 glide path is what will end those programs. I can hold for questions at the end. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Erickson, very much. Mr. Boyd, welcome to the table, and please introduce yourself and continue.
Thank you, Co-Chair Baker. My name is Eric Boyd. I'm the North Region President of ARCSIS. We are the nation's largest firm for inspections, energy efficiency, and risk management for home builders in the United States. We operate in 28 states, and in Minnesota, we touch 58% of the homes built in Minnesota in the 9-county metro area and 1 in 7 homes built in the United States. I was an active participant in the 2012 tag, the 2021 tag, and the 2024 tag, although I wore different hats, some with the Department of Commerce and some as a member of an energy efficiency group or a representative for the builders. Before joining ARCSIS, I worked at the Department of Commerce, and I worked as a builder, and I've worked in, as a trade partner. I can see this from many different hats. This is a very difficult decision to make, but I think the thing we have to think about is what is best for Minnesota and what is best for homeowners from Minnesota. No one builds more energy-efficient homes in Minnesota. We are the nation's number one builder at scale, and we are on one of the worst codes in the United States. So to think that going above and beyond is going to help us, I think, is a false statement. There has not been a case in that we've seen in this nine states that I manage where we see people go above and beyond the code that has gone in and not cost more money and cause significant delays in permits. In the state of Washington, they've adopted the 2021 IECC and gone well above and beyond it. We've seen six-month delays, and we've seen cost increases between $10,000 and $30,000 per home for an energy code that goes well above and beyond the model code. In Kansas City, we saw where the 2024 was adopted, and it's halted permits for 6 months till the point they repealed it. We see this code in Colorado, and what we're asking for is to just adopt the base model code. It's going to increase efficiency. It's going to help us, and what we need to do is let DLI and make this decision and follow the model code and increase, steadily increase what we're trying to do, and let the builders build and let people buy homes.
Thank you very much for your testimony. You finished?
Yes.
Wasn't sure. Okay. Yep. Just want to make sure. Thank you so much for that. Anyone in the audience, again, I'm not looking for like 10 more people, but is there anybody that really has some important issue to bring up? We want to make sure that your voices are heard. Seeing none from the audience, I will close that public testimony. Thank you, everybody, for testifying today. I'm now going to move to member questions regarding the bill as amended. Members, any questions for either any of the testifiers or the author? Chair Pinto?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wondered if Eric Fowler from Fresh Energy is still in the room and could come up.
And as Mr. Fowler comes up, Mr. Chair, too, I was thinking the plan for this bill is to try to take a vote on this today to see if it moves on to the general register. We're hoping that we have this good conversation, so I'm hoping to take a vote today to members' awareness. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I was looking at the materials in the packet, and in particular the one from Fresh Energy, which is maybe about halfway through for those of us in the room with the stapled packets. I just wanted to ask you about the chart showing the comparison of the mortgage increase that comes from a stronger energy code as compared with energy bill decrease. Because there was a comment that mortgages don't take into account utility bills, but can you just sort of explain that chart and kind of how that fits with the idea that a mortgage mortgages don't necessarily take into account utility costs?
Mr. Fowler, welcome back.
Thank you to the chair. Thank you, committee members. Happy to touch on that. The chart in that handout is specifically looking at the cost effectiveness information from Pacific Northwest National Lab, looking at the last time they did a calculation for Minnesota specifically, which was on the 2021 IECC, in which they found that mortgage payments that the code could potentially increase mortgage payments by between $10 and $16 per month, while lowering energy bills between $18 and $31 per month. And then it also contains information that the incremental upfront cost, because of course you have closing costs and whatnot, that those would increase between $351 and $556. So that is a one-time increase. And then you have those permanent savings of $18 to $31 per month based on the energy prices as predicted at the time of that report, which of course we know as any energy costs increase, that cost effectiveness only gets better and better.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Baker. So essentially saying that the cost of ownership goes down as a result of increasing, which makes sense if you have a home that is more efficient and over time. So thank you to you. And then I wanted to see if the Department of Labor and Industry has a position on the bill and can just provide input on that. Thank you, Chair.
Anybody here from Labor? I see Josiah is here. Welcome, Mr. Moore. Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I'm really just asking for the agency's position on the bill. Thank you.
Mr. Moore.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Pinto, for the question. The department does have...
I want to introduce yourself, please. Thank you.
Thank you.
I know you, but not everybody knows you, Josiah, so...
Josiah Moore, Legislative Director, Department of Labor and Industry.
Thank you.
The department does have some concerns with the bill. Mainly, we are concerned about going from a energy efficiency standard in current law to an energy efficiency standard that would lead to a less energy efficient code. We're also concerned that there may be some unintended consequences with the DE on our current code adoption process. The bill is introduced, struck language from statute, but the DE does introduce new language into statute prescribing how the code adoption process would have to work. So there could be some unintended consequences there. And then lastly, sorry, one moment, let me look at my notes. Lastly, I just wanted to highlight that the TAG process for code adoption that we do follow does take cost into account, and that we do think that process works, and we're really able to hear from stakeholders, respond to specific cost concerns, and the Construction Codes Advisory Council actually did respond to a lot of cost concerns in their recommendations for code adoption. So just wanted to highlight that we think that process works really well to address cost concerns.
Chair Pinto?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, and thank you so much. I think, Ben, nothing needed more. And I'll just close with a comment, Mr. Chair. I'm struck by the volume of letters and submissions echoing the testimony in opposition to the bill and in support of the existing code. But more than that, just the specificity. I pointed out in my question, Mr. Erickson, the chart showing that over time this saves homeowners money, but also some of the details about all the other factors driving up housing costs, and just as I'm flipping through the pages, powerful information that what the updated code does is that it not only is better for our environment and addressing climate change, et cetera, but saving people money and recognizing that that's in the long run, because of course our housing stock is not something that's a short-term thing. It's going to be in place for a very long time. We want to make sure that over time that we are being safe and healthy and being energy efficient as well. So I appreciate the conversation. Thank you, Representative Mecklen, for bringing it forward. I do have significant concerns, though, with the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Co-Chair Pinto. Any comments before I go to the next comment or to the next member, Representative Mecklen?
If you have questions, Chair Baker, we'll keep continuing with that.
Okay, sounds good. Representative Wayne Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative, for bringing this forward. Do we have the first presenter still here?
Ms. Peterson? Angela Peterson.
I just have some number questions.
Yep, she's coming up, so go ahead.
Thank you. I just was wondering, you brought up some numbers at the beginning regarding what you show as far as payback and ultimate savings and stuff like that. Can you provide those numbers again and where you provided those numbers? Because those are, I think, in stark contrast to the sheet we have here. And so I was just wondering, can you share those again and where those are?
Ms. Peterson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for the question. So the numbers that I shared were that the simple payback is 5 to 9 years, and it would save homeowners between $17,500 and $37,000 over 30 years. These are complicated numbers. There's a lot of different ways to look at them. These particular numbers came from a study recently done by Slipstream, which is another nonprofit organization that evaluated the cost for applying to the new code, the code that is currently underway in Minnesota, and then comparing that with energy savings estimates from Pacific Northwest National Laboratory, which is nationally recognized as the leader in the values around these codes.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. Can you expand on those numbers a little bit more as far as what did they use to calculate the average utility cost is in the home to begin with without it and what it would be if they were actually implemented. Because just with my experience of being in the HVAC industry and seeing a lot of utilities and stuff like that, what the average price of electricity and gas is, what numbers did they use to calculate to the numbers that you're sharing with us?
Well, we'd have Yes, Mr. Chair, and thank you. The numbers, those numbers, the utility savings come from Pacific Northwest National Laboratories, so we'd have to dig into their methodology of how they do that, but they're specifically related to the climate zone 6 and 7 that we have here in Minnesota.
Representative Johnson.
I would like to see those because your numbers are impressive. They're way off of this number, but when you start taking into account if, say, the average utility cost is $300 in a house and you start going into a town home, which is even less, smaller home has a smaller utility bill, and then all of a sudden figuring, are you going to basically eliminate all the utility costs in order to get to the numbers that you have? I just, coming from an industry that used to use the numbers to get people to upgrade to more efficient equipment. Mm-hmm. We eventually got away from that because it got to the point where you really couldn't prove it, and it was just assumptions going from a 92 to a 97, and based on your home, a town home, you can't get payback within 5 to 7 years when you're paying thousands more for a piece of equipment. I just would like to have more regarding those numbers, what make up those numbers, and specifically what type of houses, size of houses, and how you get there. I mean, of course, the bigger the house, the easier it is to get to those numbers.
So, Ms. Peterson, I don't know if that was that a question?
Yes.
Because otherwise, okay, and then I'll wrap it up.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Peterson.
So the numbers of the cost come from RS Means, which is a very commonly used bidding tool for, and they walked through, I think the example house was the 2,500 square foot house, which is actually significantly smaller square footage than the average new home constructed in Minnesota today. And then the PNNL numbers, I think it was right around that 2,500 square foot house with a basement that would be relatively typical for Minnesota. Like I said, it's actually smaller than a current home being built in Minnesota. And PNNL uses modeling to calculate annual savings, and then this is looking at that at a monthly basis and how that plays out over the years.
Any follow-up, Representative Johnson? Otherwise, what I'm going to ask the testifier to do, if you could, mm-hmm. if you're looking for more information, if you could pass some of that on to the committee administrator after the meeting, we can certainly share that with others, too, because I want to move on to the next one. Yeah, final follow-up.
Follow-up. Thank you. One of the things that I would just like to follow from a follower, other testifier, was keeping the outdoors in and the indoors, outdoors out and the indoors in, which I think is an interesting statement because there's so much money being spent now by homeowners and so much on the line of how you start bringing the outdoors in, because all these efficient homes, the more efficient you make them, the sicker you make the homes, because now we have air exchangers, even burping the home so you can open up windows to bring air in and starting to bring it in, because these homes are getting poorer and poorer air quality inside of it. Also, I just, one last thing is just when we are discussing in housing, and as Representative Mecklen brought up, we're talking about down payments, we're talking about property insurance, we're talking about property taxes that are keeping people out from buying their homes. We're not talking about utility costs. That's not even on the radar. So, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair Baker, and classic Representative Mecklen. I just want to acknowledge there's a lot of team housing members in here and folks who are coming at this from different angles who are working together in many ways to solve the housing crisis that we have in Minnesota. I think it's no illusions that we're in a crisis, an affordability crisis, and working on Yes to Homes and our zoning reform and a lot of the pieces in here. So just thank you for the work on that. Maybe this is a question for Fresh Energy, who was up here speaking before, but just kind of bouncing off the last point around utilities and insurance and a lot of the things that we're seeing that are contributing to the housing affordability crisis, you know, tariffs, property insurance is one of the biggest things that we're hearing. In fact, in the housing committee, we created a whole task force around insurance, and one of the biggest drivers of that is climate change and polluters. We've got building prices for materials, labor challenges, interest rates. But if Fresh Energy, if you would be willing to come back up, I think you were speaking to.
Mr. Fowler, could you come back up, please, and then go ahead and answer your ask your question, please.
I guess my question is around, as you've seen these energy standards across the country, what impact have you seen on building permits, but also are you seeing other benefits or impacts that are beyond just the pricing, but say around public health or those other livability factors?
Mr. Fowler.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. I appreciate that. I'm writing down the parts of the question was around permits and
like public health. Are you seeing with less pollution that we're seeing mm-hmm. increase, less increases in asthma, heart attacks, those kind of climate impacts?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Fowler.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate the questions and the opportunity. There has been research by, I would point to ACEEE, American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy, as well as the Midwest Energy Efficiency Alliance for some of their research on the impact on permits. Specifically, MEA, Midwest Energy Efficiency Alliance, studied code updates in Illinois and what happened with neighboring counties in states next door that didn't have the same code update, and they did not find a difference in the number of permits and new home starts. And then, in terms of public health, I think there is quite a lot to say about the reduced emissions and quality. And maybe rather than list a bunch of studies or something, I might point folks to the letter again from Habitat Itasca County and the family that was able to move into their new 2038 standard home. So this would already be compliant with what we're looking at rolling out, not until 2038. And the asthma issues of the child in that family were greatly improved when they were able to move into this much more healthy home as well.
Representative Kozolski, follow up.
Thank you, Chair Baker, and thank you for that. You know, that's something that when we're looking around the true costs, insurance and utilities are actually for especially affordable homes. So I appreciate that note that you mentioned about the not seeing an increase on building permits. We know that, nationally electricity rose 6.6% last year, and we're expecting to see gas as well increase or double. And I just want to note for members that 100,000 Minnesotans had their utilities shut off in the last year to this spring, and we are facing not only an evictions crisis, but we're also seeing a number of foreclosures or people who are coming and they're able to get caught up. There might be a month or two behind a mortgage. They're able to get caught up after getting a foreclosure notice. And then they're in this like game of cat and mouse where they get caught up, they get behind again. And a lot of that is the drivers that we're seeing from utility costs. So this is work that I'm grateful for Representative Kraft that goes together with our zoning and our yes to homes. And if we don't help Minnesotans on the utility as well as for them to be able to have a clean living environment with the public health aspect, we've got to take care of it all and look at it holistically. And so for those reasons and more, I would say we'll not be supporting this bill, but look forward to continue to work on these issues with you.
Thank you, Representative Berg.
Sorry, just making a mess over here. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for bringing this bill forward, Representative Meckland. There are a variety of reasons that young people and all people have difficulty affording homes or to buy a first home these days, not the least of which is this disastrous economy, which is kind of crazy because we have billions of dollars to invest in ICE and Department of Homeland Security, which is a choice because those dollars could go to helping people afford homes. Energy efficiency is not the barrier to affording homes. It is the process through which homeowners can actually save money in the long run, not to mention our planet. If we don't mitigate the climate crisis, home prices won't matter because this planet will be uninhabitable. So those, and also the numbers that you are hearing from hours and hours of reputable research, and the resources available, I don't know how they're going to match the members on the numbers on your sheet, but we have heard from the witness where the numbers came from, how true the numbers are, and I'm inclined to believe the research. So I will not be supporting this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Are we okay over there?
We're okay. We're holding it down at 8:15.
Watch your water over there. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually, as someone who's not an expert in this, but have spent some time talking to Representative Kraft and others, know from both Representative Kraft, and I think it's in the materials, that other states have adopted policies like this, including Pennsylvania, which I actually think has stricter standards. And what they saw was, at the beginning, the incremental cost that I think you're talking about, upfront costs, disappeared with a higher local energy efficiency in the market. And I'm wondering why you think that Minnesota and our great builders and workers and architects can't accomplish what other states have accomplished, which is seeing that that upfront cost disappear.
Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Greenman, I do this for a living, and right now I think we have three projects where the homeowners are opting to put in more accelerated energy efficiency because they can afford it. It does cost more. Spray foam costs more than bad insulation. It's a plain and simple fact. But when you start mandating things, things get far more expensive. We talk about return on investment. You can't get a return on investment when you can't if you can't buy the property in the first place. Because there's no way to save money in a house it is which you do not live. So I am not against increasing the energy efficiency of a building envelope by any means. However, mandating it, forcing many people to not even be able to afford to get into it, is not necessarily the greatest plan, particularly when, for some reason, our state seems to have very escalated costs of homeownership compared to neighboring states. There's one of the national builders can build the exact same house here they can in Indiana, and it's over $100,000 cheaper in Indiana for the exact same product. What we're doing is not helping people achieve homeownership. And this is, if people can afford it, that's great. I enjoy it. I enjoy learning about all the new technologies and new stuff. I will say, though, in my own house, and I have a lot of light bulbs in my house, and I went and bought LED light bulbs, and I bought an air source heat pump. And while it does save money, I will never live long enough to get the return on that air source heat pump for the additional cost it cost me. That's just reality. But it also gives me the ability to shift back and forth. So sometimes I'm using fuel, sometimes I'm using electrical. I'm concerned about this particular policy when some of my colleagues on the other side of the aisle are pushing for electrification of all electric cars. So if your electric use is going to keep going up, because if you may invest in an electric car, you may swap out your gas water heater to electric, how are you judging the baseline if their power consumption is going down? I don't even understand how this is possible. If you say you got to reduce your energy use, but you're adding more energy consumption by switching from a gas appliance to electric appliance, I haven't figured out how they're going to make that rationale, comparatively speaking. Like I said, if people want to do this, do it. But mandating it will make it more expensive. It does. Because you don't have a choice. You have to do it now. Because the government said so.
Representative Greenman, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I didn't hear an answer, which is why other states have seen, as they have adopted these standards, and frankly stricter standards, they have seen the disappearance of that upfront marginal cost. And what concerns me is, I understand from a builder's perspective why you wouldn't be thinking about the long term, about those utilities costs, The builders aren't paying the 20 years of utilities that homeowners are. And so when we talk about affordability, I understand why the builders, and we have a pretty consolidated market, I believe, in Minnesota, and so there's also a profit margin issue, but why the builders would say all we're focusing on is that upfront ticket price. But somebody who's paying their utilities every month, money is fungible, right? If you get $12 more on your mortgage and $18 less on your utility bill, that's not going to help the builder. But that certainly will help the homeowner. And so I think, members, as it relates to both affordability, also good policy, and just when we're talking about the things that are driving up costs, I mean, I think it's great that you switch to electric, because we are right now at war with Iran, and as we see fossil fuel prices go through the roof, that's not a cost that Minnesotans can budget for. Or as we see tariffs that are, I know, driving up building costs, that's also not something that Minnesotans feel like they can have control over. But having an energy efficient home where you are using less energy and your utility bill is going down, that is something that you can price in. So members, this is a bad bill. I think it's bad for affordability. And I think we should all vote no.
Final quick, Representative Wayne Johnson, back at you. Wrap up.
Thank you, Chair. I'd just like to comment on that this is an affordability issue, because I can tell you, as a builder or as a HVAC contractor, you love to put in more efficient equipment because it's that much more expensive. And the more expensive the equipment is, the higher margins you get to charge, and especially if the homeowner is told, you have no choice. You have no choice at this cheaper one and this one. So this is actually a win for builders, and they can make a lot more money because you're forcing them to do it. They're buying a lot more, and the margins are there. So that's why it is an affordable issue. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Again, I think I'm going to go to closing comments now at this point. Again, I've asked members, we are going to take a vote on this. So I'd like to move this along. This is an important issue. Again, there's two sides to this. I have many people in my district that are also fighting to try to get out of their rental properties. They want to buy their own place. They are just begging to do it. These are very, very important decisions that we try to make while we are in session to try to help not only keep our homes efficient and in Minnesota climate, and it sounds like with testifiers, Minnesota does a terrific job already. The affordability issue is real. Property taxes has come up, insurance costs, other things, and they're real. I just know when we see around the state, this is one of the small things we can do to try to elevate that. Again, I appreciate you bringing the bill forward. I'll let you wrap things up before I take the vote with the members. So,
Mr. Chair, my apologies.
I'm sorry.
Roll call requested.
Roll call requested. Thank you, Mr. Sure. Chairman. So with that, Representative Shane Mecklen, would you please final up your bill as amended?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Like I said, you know, in late 1999 to 2001, someone there, Minnesota, adopted the build it tight, ventilate it right methodology. As somebody mentioned, the air quality inside a home today is 80 to 100 times worse than the outside ambient air. A microbiologist, immunologist, a gentleman that lives in my district, he did a massive study about 20 years ago on asthma, because that was mentioned by Representative Kozlowski. And ironically, what he found is kids that grow up on a farm, particularly with livestock, never get asthma. Interesting study. So there's a lot of things that go into it. As I think Representative Johnson mentioned, we do use these air-to-air exchangers that became mandated back then to try to improve the air quality inside of a very tight envelope. I can assure you from working on homes, the homes that didn't have house wrap, just maybe a tar paper underneath the siding, the wood sheathing is in much better shape. We don't always make the right decisions going forward. So. I'm looking at this from an affordability standpoint, and again, I'm going to renew my motion, Chair Baker, to House File 3545 as amended to be moved to the General Register, and I believe Chair Pinto called for a roll call. Thank you.
Yep, that is correct, and thank you for that. With a roll call being requested, that will be done. I'll have the CLA take the roll call. The Chair will vote aye.
Chair Pinto.
No.
Vice Chair Mecklen.
Aye.
Vice Chair Greenman.
No.
Representative Bakeberg.
Yes.
Representative Berg.
No.
Representative Frazier.
No.
Representative Hussein.
No.
Representative Johnson Pete.
No.
Representative Johnson, Wayne.
Aye.
Representative Kozlowski.
No.
Representative Mueller.
Mueller votes yes.
Representative Schultz.
Schultz, aye.
Representative Zalesnikar.
Zalesnikar, aye.
All right, thank you, members, for the vote. We have a 7-7 tie, so the motion today, the bill as presented, is not adopted and passing, so we'll lay this bill on the table. With that, thank you very much for your testifying today, and you're bringing the bill forward to the testifiers as well. I will ask Vice Chair Mecklen to come to the chair table, and I'm going to present my next bill for House File 4004. If I can also have Explore Minnesota come and join me at the table, too.
We do have a script if you wanted it. So he's going to say this part.
Yep.
Mr. Chair.
Chair Baker, would you like to move
yes.
your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, thank you very much for allowing, well, thanks me to be allowing to have me here at the House File today. How's that sound? Pretty good. House File 4004 around something that I'm very passionate about, which is the hospitality industry. With me today is Explore Minnesota, and we've actually been visiting about trying to right-size the advisory council. I appreciate the work that Explore Minnesota has been doing. I've got an amendment in front of the members to kind of just get the language right. We've kind of realized that there were some mistakes made in the drafting of this. We don't want to reduce it that dramatically. I'm going to have Director
Bennett McGilley.
Thank you, the director, to explain that amendment to you all, and I'll take it at that point. Now, Mr. Chair, the director.
Please proceed.
Explain the amendment.
Identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair and members. I'm Lauren Bennett McGinty, Executive Director of Explore Minnesota. The bill in front of you simply adjusts the various council memberships. The amendment itself is to clarify some language we had said. For some reason, it was edited to be 5 representatives from each of the tourism marketing regions versus 1 representative from each of the 5 regions. So just clarifying, we didn't want to multiply by 5. We wanted to keep it a little simpler. The bill itself is really simplifying and making it more efficient for us to run the tourism and business councils. We've been asked to do an efficiency package, but we've also been asked to reduce the council as we are one of the largest councils in state government currently. The goal here is really to ensure that participation is better. To date, participation sits at usually 50 to 60% of the actual council. Many seats are currently vacant and are difficult to fill. So reducing the meetings per year and consolidating the membership will allow us to ensure that our meetings are more substantive, and it will also ensure that the seats are filled. We've kind of consolidated some of the seats to account for statewide associations that represent the various industry stakeholder groups. So again, it's sort of removing redundancies. And I think that's kind of the outline, but I'm happy to take questions.
And that would be the amendment as well. So I'd like to ask that we adopt the amendment and then proceed with the discussion of the bill.
To the A1 amendment, any member questions? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So moved.
And Mr. Chair, as amended, again, I'll take membership questions at this point. But again, having sat on the advisory council in the past myself, I have seen the work that Explore Minnesota has done with tours around the state. We've had a lot of meetings in my tenure there. This is an efficiency bill for an agency. I think we should appreciate this kind of work. I think going down to 2 meetings a day, 2 meetings a year would be a good move. Right now it's currently 4. Right-sizing the council is a good move for this as well. A lot of effort goes into planning these things, and it's important that we have a very engaged advisory council. So with that, Mr. Chair and members, I would take questions.
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Baker. My only question about this is I noticed that the changes remove the automatic designation as co-chairs for the executive director and the deed commissioner. And I'm just curious, I didn't see another place where co-chairs are chosen. Is there not a co-chair? Or I'm not sure. Yeah, just curious about that.
Chair Baker,
Director.
Chair. the business council was developed about 2 years ago in conjunction with our work with Deed. That council has also been very difficult to fill all the positions, but even more so, we have found over the last 2 years that the council for Explore Minnesota for Business was truly run by Explore Minnesota. We very much appreciate the time and energy that Deed has put into it, but to have a co-chair in that space, it's not necessary, and it's specific to that one council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I wonder if maybe then you might want to, because you've actually removed the designation of anybody as a chair, including you, at least by the way I'm reading this. Maybe I'm misunderstanding it, but it doesn't say the executive director is the chair.
Which line are you looking at? I'm sorry,
Mr. Chair. Look at line 1.10 and 1.11. At least that's how I read it. Ms. Shaleen, maybe may correct me on that in my reading of it.
Director?
Chair and chair, that is correct. It is not meant to be a free-for-all, so we can make some adjustments. I'm sure that we can work on an amendment. I will say there were a few mistakes that we have found, so we will need to make some corrections, but I appreciate that you called
good.
To attention.
Good, making sure.
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, and then thank you, Director, for bringing this forward, and Chair Baker for carrying it. These changes do make sense to me as I'm looking at them, so I appreciate it. Thank you, Chair.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, on that too as well, Mr. Chair. We will continue to work on this to make it right. So our plan is to hopefully get this to the General Register, and we can work on it from there. So thank you.
Any other member questions? Representative Keselowski.
Thank you, Chair Macklin and Chair Baker and Director for bringing this forward. I just have two quick questions. The first one on 2.4 for the two representatives from the Minnesota Unitary Council on Tribal Leadership. I just asked because I know sometimes MIAC has said things have been brought forward and then they didn't know that they were appointed. So could you just speak to what maybe consultation and then are they signed off on having representatives from MIAC and the Tribal Leadership Council?
Director.
Chair and representative, yes, we have consulted with them. I will say the way this is worded, again, still needs some adjustments, but we as well as the governor's office have reached out to MIAC to consult on this, and we do currently have representatives from MIAC on the council, and they've been great. So I'm happy to kind of continue that.
Any other member questions? Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair. And that's fantastic. Thank you, Director, for that. And then the second part, I would just say on the 2.6 for the one Dakota representative and one Ojibwe representative, always love to see that representation, but I noticed that it crosses out the ethnic chambers. And just curious if you could talk us through how you got to that decision and if ethnic council members would be included in another way that you envision.
Director.
Chair and representative, again, that is one of the issues that we had found after this was drafted is that it then adds two members, and then the intention was to specify under 2.4 that it would be one Dakota and one Ojibwe and not cross out the ethnic chamber. So we are hoping to remedy that situation, but I appreciate you flagging that, and we will be able to discuss as well.
Representative, because also your follow-up.
Just real quick. No, and thank you, Chair, and I appreciate that. And for the crossing out of ethnic chambers, can you just clarify if those folks would be included in another way or other engagement?
Director.
Chair and representative, the goal was not to cross that out, and it also accidentally, so it sort of shifts the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. So we want to keep Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. We want to keep ethnic chambers. And again, just kind of fixing some of the unfortunate deleted items.
No. Any follow-up, Representative Kozlowski? Nope. Okay. And Chair Baker.
Thank you, members. Again, I appreciate the ability to have questions. I will continue to work on this bill with the director and Explore Minnesota to make sure that we've got this thing better tweaked as it moves forward here. So with that, members, I appreciate a yes vote on moving this to the next step, to the General Register. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 4004 as amended to the General Register.
Thank you. And if that, all of those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? So done. It passed. And as a mention to the director, just for you, I wore Explore Minnesota socks today.
All right, members, next up, we've got a presentation from the Minnesota Chamber. If Ms. Shothorse could come forward, please. And we've got, I think, about 15, 20 minutes or so scheduled for this. So if we could pull up the presentation, I believe this is an update on the paid family medical leave feedback that a lot of her members have been sharing and giving feedback on. So welcome to the committee. And please introduce yourself when you're ready and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lauren Shothorse, and I'm the Director of Workplace Management and Workforce Development Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, a statewide business organization representing more than 6,300 businesses and over 500,000 employees across the state. The majority of our members are small and mid-sized businesses. Thank you for having me here today to share the results of our paid family and medical leave user experience survey. Restoring balance and ensuring employer-focused flexibility in workplace mandates is one of the Chamber's top legislative priorities year over year. This year in particular, making adjustments to the state's now in effect paid leave mandate before things get too far out of alignment is top of mind for Minnesota's business community. Our members believe that the legislature must address operational challenges for both employers and employees to ensure that the program is functional, cost-controlled, and responsive to workplace dynamics. The potential for overuse, abuse, and fraud must be closely monitored and eliminated as well. It's clear that legislators need to hear the full story from users, both employers and employees, not just administrators and colleagues, both positive and negative, and importantly, constructive. That is why we just conducted a robust survey over the past 2 months, focusing on the user experience, so we could bring meaningful, comprehensive user feedback directly to the Capitol. Thanks to the nearly 700 business leaders and employees who took the time to share their line of sight into paid leave management experience, we have a statistically meaningful snapshot of business sentiment on a qualitative and quantitative level on the actual experience with paid leave from business owners and HR departments, from interactions with the agency running the program, and from employees. As you'll see in the presentation, we asked about 15 basic demographic and utilization questions and 4 open-ended questions. Most of this presentation will focus on the verbatims. The results, which I'll get into in a moment, should generally come as no surprise, and there is nothing that I will consider to be earth-shattering as the concerns we raised about the potential impacts of what would happen should this bill be enacted operationally, economically, and on workforce availability terms is bearing out in reality now that the mandate is fully in effect. It's also the case that multiple things can be true at the same time, and there are trade-offs and unintended consequences of policy decisions. For some individuals, this mandate provides a new benefit they previously did not have access to. That's overwhelmingly a good thing based on the feedback we received. Unfortunately, though, that comes with costs, existing benefit disruptions, administrative burdens, and risks for everyone else. That's what we're going to talk about today. Remember, nearly 80% of chamber members offered paid leave in some form to their employees prior to the enactment of this mandate, and now they're taxed to do it in an overly prescriptive manner. A couple of basic demographic stats for you. As you can see on this slide, 78% of respondents have less than 100 employees, but even more significantly, 40% of respondents represent some of the smallest businesses with less than 10 employees. So the feedback you'll hear today is quite representative of the small, mainstream business perspective, who described the paid leave experience so far as negative. A theme throughout the responses is this program was not designed for small businesses. One respondent noted, "We are a small business and this is going to hurt us in the long run. We're already paying enough for every other big business and now they want to make the mom and pop businesses run like the big ones." On this slide, you can also see an industry breakdown. As the state's manufacturing association, we like to be aware of trends as well as how the impacts of state policy on a particular industry follow or deviate from the broader experience. In a slide or two, you'll see an example of this. In addition to the demographic questions, we wanted to get a sense of the state plan, private plan breakdown. As you can see on this slide, most employers are using the state plan, particularly small employers, which aligns with what the department's reported. I do think this particular set of respondents might be slightly higher utilizers of private plans in general, and one point to note is that manufacturers in the survey are heavier users of private plans. Here you can see the breakdown of filed claims, and there are a few things to point out regarding this data. First, 42% of the respondents have a filed claim. So in the first 2 months of the program, there is quite a bit of direct claims experience to pull from, though to be clear, there is also quite a bit of too soon to tell. However, I'd like to direct your attention to the data, what the data shares about exposure and impact. Nearly two-thirds of those with filed claims have multiple claims. In fact, over 22% in this subset of respondents have claims filed in the double digits. As a threshold issue, depending on the size of a company or a facility location, a specific department or a production line, the numbers reveal a serious potential hardship issue for employers, and nothing in the law currently provides any sort of consideration for this, perhaps something for policymakers to look into. According to one respondent, this multi-extended leave scenario would not simply be an inconvenience, it would suspend revenue-generating activity altogether and permanently destabilize my business. Another shared, while the program has promises, there seems to be a lack of checks and balances in place to ensure that it is not causing undue hardship on the employer. For example, we have a location with only 5 employees, and the program has approved 3 of them to be out on leave during the same time frame. This puts a huge financial strain on the employer to find subcontractors or temporary employees to be able to maintain operations. On the right-hand side, you can also see a splice out of data. Manufacturers are 3 times more likely to report having 6 or more claims, and metro employers are nearly 2 times as likely to report 6 or more claims. On this slide, you can see the types of claims that have been filed. On an individual claim type level, bonding is the most utilized benefit at 24%, followed closely by medical at 22%, then family leave at 13%, which generally tracks the order and frequency of the state's reported data. Combination claims were reported to be the highest for our respondents at 38%. I don't have the specific breakdown of those combinations, but given the way the program is designed, folks were expecting to see a somewhat significant number of these combination claims. Here we asked if employers have needed to formally engage on any claims. Given the concerns about the role of employers in this process and the unfamiliarity by employees with the program, I was very curious to see the results of this question. One employer pointed out, in general, even though the program is administered by the state, the employer still has a lot of responsibility in reporting discrepancies, helping employees apply for the correct type of benefits, for the correct duration, and really just troubleshooting issues. Another explained employees have reported inconsistent or confusing email notifications regarding the status of an application or how to adjust an application that was previously submitted. So it's a good thing to see the percentage of contested claims under 10% and those moving to an appeal even lower. What this slide doesn't specify, however, is what showed up quite a bit in our verbatim responses is employee-initiated challenges or employers challenging determinations made on their small business designation or seasonal employer designation itself, which is actually an area of policy for you to look into addressing. The next series of slides will dive into the top themes that showed up repeatedly throughout the open-ended questions. Starting with administrative burden and confusion, we'll also hear about approvals and communication, staffing and operational disruption, cost concerns and one-size-fits-all frustration, seasonal, multi-entity, and cross-border complications, perceived incentives for overuse, abuse, and fraud, and then the employee reaction. The core takeaway is that employers aren't just debating the idea of paid leave. I will say again, as I've said many times before, over 80% of chamber members offered paid leave in some form to their employees prior to this mandate going into effect. What they're describing is a program that in practice is hard to administer, slow or unclear in execution, and most disruptive for small, seasonal, or lean-staffed organizations. And there's a strong concern that it may be financially unsustainable in the long run or vulnerable to misuse. And the next series of slides do have a lot on them. I'm not going to read everything on them. You can see quotes on the right-hand side that are direct from our respondents as it relates to the issue at hand. And that's because we think it's important policymakers to not only understand the experience at a macro level, but to hear it in the small business's own words. As policymakers, you only hear often that we oppose, but don't understand how complicated it is to implement seemingly simple things. And this program is not simple. Which is why the administrative burden about confusion and the implementation of this new law is so significant. Businesses don't want to be out of compliance. Respondents shared a lot about their experiences with learning about the law and coming into compliance. With the short implementation timeline and the availability of complete guidance and information, many felt both the state and their own organizations needed more time to prepare. In addition, it is impossible for lawmakers and regulators to fully understand and appreciate the unique business models, the variety of benefits packages, and workplace dynamics. And many policymakers do not write new laws taking into account existing laws. So there is a lot to be said about the lack of alignment between policy vision and reality. It's not easy, and the department has been really trying to figure out the best way to be that bridge, which should be noted. On this slide, you'll see feedback relating to slow approvals and inconsistent information. We're a little over 2 months in, and folks do understand it is a new program, and this is a tremendous and frustrating transition time for everyone. What our members want us and all of you to keep an eye on is making sure the system moves and improves with time and experience. The department has clearly stated its iterative and continuous improvement process. If issues reveal that policy changes are needed to ensure certain improvements happen, we expect there to be a legislative path forward. In addition, by nature, this program requires a process that includes lag times and multi-data entry points, which injects friction into the system. So any additional delays or uncertainties above and beyond normal process compound the subsequent issues or problems. The feedback on this slide relates to staffing and operational disruption, and it is really a fundamental issue. Workplaces are already short-staffed in Minnesota, and it is expensive to replace staff or train replacements, if candidates even exist. Any extended leave, whether or not it is for a legitimate reason, impacts operations. Employers spend a lot of time and resources hedging against and preparing for this inevitability. Incentivized leave all but ensures higher utilization, which comes through as a concern in the survey responses, and therefore operational and staffing impacts. This is one of the reasons why the chamber and its members have asked you to refine the scope of the mandate time and again. But costs still do matter, especially for small businesses, even with a reduced payroll tax. Margins are tight, and this mandate is not the cost of a cup of coffee. Beyond just the payroll tax, it's the cost to comply. It's the redundancy costs, the costs to redo comp structures and operations plans, the increased property taxes to cover the public sector, and the increased cost of goods and services to account for the increased cost of business in the state as a result of this and other mandates. But it's also the cost of the payroll tax. One respondent said it best. In general, we are supportive of the concept, but the economics feel out of whack for employers. We comment quite a bit about one-size-fits-all mandates in our testimony, but we received a lot of feedback about how this mandate doesn't fit within the operational realities of various entities. Small seasonal employers in particular, but self-employed individuals, profit-sharing organizations, limited-hour organizations, those with ratioed workforce, and those with student workers, among a few. Border businesses with multi-state workforce and variable work schedules have additional cost and compliance challenges. Exemptions or alternative structures for small or certain businesses shouldn't be considered unreasonable. Outright fraud is, of course, top of mind, but so is the issue of abuse and overuse. Beyond just anti-fraud sentiments, employers are reporting a few concerning trends. A few examples. Providers are being pressured by patients for the full 12 weeks of leave, even if their condition does not require it. A number of respondents have shared that their employees are making more on paid leave than the wage replacement thresholds in law. Employees are going on vacation or to music festivals while supposedly on leave. These anecdotes don't necessarily reveal fraud or a lack of oversight by the department. They highlight concerns with the broad eligibility and limited employer recourse elements of the law. To employers, overuse is abuse. But it's not all doom and gloom. On this slide, you can see that for some respondents, things are working. For others, the program is operating within expectations. And just to share some friendly interagency competition, one respondent flagged that to date, paid leave is significantly less impactful and drama-filled than the Sick and Safe Time program. Turning to the employee experience, we asked a direct question about what challenges employees are reporting. About a third of respondents indicated a reporting issue, with filing a claim as being the most reported issue, followed by receiving benefits and then setting up an account. But, as you can see, over 55% of respondents didn't indicate any reported issues on behalf of their employees, which is hopefully a good trend to build on. We are hearing, however, that employers are surprised by how much their employees are asking for their assistance in the process and possibly triaging issues before they become problems. Which, as you can see on this slide, our employers are also surprised by the negative employee reactions to paid leave. This is more to the mandate itself versus the result of a negative interaction with a portal or a claim. Most predominantly, employees are upset about the payroll tax coming out of their paycheck to finance the program and feeling like they did not have a say in the position, in the imposition of this new tax on their wages. To that point, workers want to opt out, but they can't under the law, adding to their frustration. We also wanted to get a sense of the volume interaction between employers and the state as a check on the design of the system. In good news, for over 60% of respondents, there hasn't been a need to contact the department outside of normal use. For the 30% of respondents who have interacted with DEED, most indicated it's due to the new administrative burden of a new program, new rules, and needing additional clarification. For those who reported a mixed outcome, generally it fell into three buckets. Questions were being generically answered, so perceived as not being helpful. Employers were hoping for quicker responses, and if speaking to multiple representatives, getting a different answer each time. But regardless of the outcome or liking the answer, most everyone said that folks on the other end of the call were kind, sympathetic, and professional. And aside from perhaps one terse call I had with a high-ranking government official yesterday about 3:28 p.m., I'd have to agree. To close it out, we asked what program changes would be most helpful to a respondent's business. Overwhelmingly, I won't say universally, but it was close. Repeal was the number one response. However, after that, respondents provided a number of more targeted suggestions. And again, you will recall all of these structural changes we've advocated for all along. Refining the scope of the mandate by reducing the number of weeks, narrowing the definition of an eligible family member, addressing the generosity of the benefit, and considering reasonable exemptions for some of the specific reasons you can see on the screen. Flexibility for small and seasonal businesses and individuals is another top request. Whether it's through exemptions or allowing opt-in or opt-out provisions or stronger job or workforce attachment requirements on the front end, the disproportionate impact on small businesses and individuals need to be addressed. Beyond the scope of the mandate itself, employers are looking for simplification in the claims process flow and in the coordination between other laws or requirements. For example, why doesn't the state's sick and safe time mandate flow into the first 7 days of the paid family medical leave mandate in a more deliberate way? Can there be consistent and appropriate approval for time off for medical conditions across the board? Based on the responses, we will be able to work with the department too on things that might not require legislative changes. To close out, employers aren't debating the idea of paid leave as a benefit to offer, but as a one-size-fits-all state-run mandate. They're describing their lived experience with implementing and operating a mandated program that, in reality, has been harder to administer, slow and unclear in execution, and disruptive to their business operations. And of course, they're sharing a strong concern about the financial sustainability or vulnerability to misuse. I hope you found the results of this survey interesting and useful in your policymaking to help make this mandate more reasonable, balanced, and work better for everyone. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Ms. Schotthorst. Again, members, this is early on. Early indications of just a quick survey from paid family. Thank you for being very balanced about this. Again, I've also found things from the department have gone well for some, you know, the staffing has been pleasant and respectful and professional. Some of the things that we're asking for has been answered. Some have not. I mean, again, it's a big program getting out the door, and we've mentioned before that it got out of the gate without falling apart from day one. That's good. That's a good thing. Any member quick questions? I don't want to take a lot of time on this because we have one more presentation. Is there any quick comments to this? Because, again, the packet is the presentation is in your packet. If you have further questions, we can certainly follow up with the chamber. Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the presentation. My question is, I see in the graph that 9% is health care, but my question is there any information, I know it's early on, but is there any information that talks about, is there increased wait times in the emergency room? You know, is there been any changes that have affected ambulance services, you know, trauma care? The shift work environment for nursing homes, assisted livings, disability group homes, where you have expected staffing ratios. So I'm interested to see if there's any studies on that to show cause and effect in regards to patient care, or if it's going to be just to expect longer wait times because the trauma or emergency and then 24-hour staffing needs are going to continue. Thank you.
Ms. Shadhorst.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zalesnikar, yes, we've heard from members of ours who are in the provider community all of those concerns and examples of that bearing out in different operations. I do believe there will be industry-specific research and data collected to those very points. I'm not focused uniquely on that particular answer, but in the feedback that we've received from those employers in that space, your concerns are valid and are being reported to us as issues, yes.
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that workers were using this to take vacations. Have I missed on the charts the research on how many vacations were taken while the claim was for being ill, using it for its proper use?
Ms. Shadhorst.
The data is not reported specifically on that, like as a data point. It comes up in the verbatims and the experience that businesses are reporting, knowing that employees are doing this when saying that. But that would possibly be a question for the department, how they're looking into those types of claims.
Follow up, Representative Berg?
Yes. Which department would you suggest? I mean, we've been talking this whole committee about how important the numbers are and matching up the numbers. So which department would I find that claim?
Department running, Mr. Chair, Representative Berg, the department running the program.
Indeed.
Okay. So not a real answer. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And final, Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your presentation. My sister works in Fargo, and I live on the border of Iowa. And when you talked about one of your top themes is the cross-border complications, you know, we have job creators who have talked about the ease of going over to a different state. And my sister, who works as an HR person in Fargo, talks about the difficulty of this program specifically for her. Is there any other additional information about any specific cross-border complications that you're hearing from our employers? And thank you, Mr. Chair. That'll be my last
question. Ms. Shadhorst.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mueller, the issue that we've heard most predominantly about is on workers who fall under UI but not paid leave or vice versa. So one of the pieces of advice I think everyone was given early on is just use UI as a proxy, but it's not exactly. And I believe the department would be able to share how they're advising businesses or what they're looking for on who qualifies for the program. I think there's some confusion or challenges with knowing when to count an employee for purposes of if they are in just UI or paid leave. It's not totally clean and clear, which is one of the issues.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Shadhorst, for the presentation today. I appreciate that. And members, again, if you have further questions, you can reach out to the Minnesota Chamber for further information. With that, I'm going to call up my last presenter today. If Mr. Rowe could come forward from the Department of Economic Development. Set this conversation up. This presentation here now is just kind of some background about the unemployment insurance kind of fund, how it works, and we currently have a sort of a maxed out assessment on the program right now. It got a lot of attention before the session. I wanted to give Mr. Rowe a chance to just help us understand the history of this, why we're here. Maybe we can have a little conversation. And members, we have a hard stop at 10 o'clock because we have a meeting immediately right after here with rules. So we need to be out at that time. So I'm going to watch that very closely. Representative Schultz, do you have a question?
Yes, just a quick question, Mr. Chair. So we have 20 minutes for this report. Is this going to be likely our only time this session to talk about UI? Is that our expectation, or are we expecting another hearing?
Thank you. Good question. We'll bring this up again. This is just more of an informational overview, so we'll have more time to talk about this at a later time. Thank you, and welcome to the committee. Mr. Rowe, please introduce yourself and present your findings of UI.
Well, good morning, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members. My name is Evan Rowe, Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Employment and Economic Development. And, I'm going to walk through just the basic mechanics of the UI rate structure. It is a structure that's built broadly to be self-correcting in relationship to the nature of the trust fund, but there have been several factors tied to the pandemic and relief of charges related to the pandemic that impact kind of the overall state of play. I'll try to take us through all the rate factors and hopefully have a little bit of time for questions and respect members' time today. So at a very high level, I wanted to talk through the mechanics of the UI tax structure here, because there's a few different components here that are all relevant to the way that the UI, that the way an employer would perceive their unemployment insurance rate. So the biggest component of the UI tax is what's called the experience rate. So that's based on an employer's usage to the program, i.e., how often do they lay workers off. That provides the vast majority of tax collections, and it's calculated over 4 years of look-back history. The reason for this is, I think, unlike other programs, there is a tie between the choices an employer makes and the impact on the overall health of the UI trust fund. There's also a base tax rate. That is the same rate for all tax-paying employers. That's largely meant that is a much smaller component of the overall UI rate for most employers. Now, there are some employers that have a very low or a zero experience rate. The base tax rate is largely meant to cover benefits that aren't able to be charged due to closes and other things like that, and generally make up for non-chargeable benefits. Those two things are taken together, and then they are multiplied by the taxable wage base for each employee. So every state does this differently. In Minnesota, the taxable wage base is an amount that's adjusted annually based on economic growth and wage growth in the state. It's tied to 60% of the state's average annual wage for the previous calendar year. And that all taken together gets to your initial amount due. On the next slide, though, there are a couple other again, you might call them assessments on top of those base rates that I just walked through. There can be an additional assessment that is triggered when the trust fund drops below a certain level. And I emphasize that they're a surtax because they are noted as like a 5 or a 10 or a 14, or there's a 0, 5, 10, or 14% level on those assessments. But that does not mean your UI rate is 14%. It's 1.05, 1.10, 1.14 multiplied by your existing tax rate. Additionally, there's a special assessment that's triggered if we are projected to be borrowing from the U.S. Treasury. That the last time that occurred was during the pandemic. The special assessment was briefly triggered when we were in borrowing status due to the unprecedented pressures placed on the UI Trust Fund due to the pandemic. So, going back to the experience rates, which again are the bulk of collections for the program and the bulk of what most employers would perceive in the program, again, it is based on the employer's use of the unemployment insurance program. So the formula, all these things are prescribed in law. The department has no discretion in this. It's not a choice. It is based on the formula. So the formula is 1.25 times the UI benefits paid to the employer's employees over the employer's total taxable payroll. It ranges from 0.0% to a statutory cap of 8.9%. And as I said earlier, it is calculated based on up to 4 years of history in the program. And I'll get into this in a little bit more detail, but pandemic-related charges are not factored in due to the trust fund replenishment law. What do we do about new employers? Well, they're assigned an industry-specific rate for their first 2 years of operation, and then once they actually have program experience, then we calculate their rate accordingly. So that's the experience rate and how it's calculated. The base tax rate is set also on a formula that's based on the balance of the trust fund on March 31st of the preceding year, over the total wages and covered employment. And I won't read the table. You have the table. That's how that ratio gets you to a condition that then triggers the various base tax and additional assessment rates. It's all designed to be self-balancing and ensure that the trust fund will be ready for the next recession. Why do we care about the total wages and covered employment? Well, that matters because as the size of the economy grows and the total wages grow, if a recession is to hit, then we would have to pay out more in unemployment insurance benefits. So, I think this formula and this process was intensively revisited in the wake of the Great Recession, so about a decade ago, to help make sure that it's self-directing and largely corrects itself. And then, as I mentioned earlier, the taxable wage base is set. It's indexed to 60% of the state's average wage for the previous calendar year. Employers only pay taxes on wages up to that amount. So in 2026, the base tax rate is 0.04%. The additional assessment, which again is a surtax, I just want to emphasize that, is 14%, and the taxable wage base is $44,000. So an employer only pays UI rates on that first $44,000 of income. Every state does it differently. Every state has different formulas in terms of how they approach that, but wanted to just walk you through how Minnesota does it. So I guess, one question that just comes up, and it's a very reasonable one, is what's going on with rates? Why are rates changing? So I think there are always a few different factors. One is that there has been strong growth in total covered wages over the last few years, as the country and Minnesota in particular has recovered strongly from the effects of the pandemic. Total wage growth has grown. That increases the denominator of that ratio for the base rate that I shared with you previously. So that increases the level of the trust fund and the elements that we would need to be able to continue to pay out benefits. The other side of it, of course, is benefit payments. And there has been increased growth in unemployment insurance. I think there's been a lot of conversation about churn in the labor market tied to a number of different factors. I won't go into those here. But it's in Minnesota, the trend, it's a consistent trend we're seeing in Minnesota that the country is seeing nationwide. There has been significant growth in UI payments over the last few years across the country, and I think it's a notable trend that's worth flagging. So that's part of the why. Another big part of the why is the nature of the trust fund replenishment, and I think policy choices that we made that the legislature and the administration made coming out of the pandemic. So ordinarily, when the trust fund falls, what tends to happen is experience rates go up for employers because layoffs increase. Those layoffs get attributed back to the employers, and that causes employers' experience rates to go up. That then helps the trust fund recover over time, but it's calculated on that four-year rolling basis. So following the Great Recession back in the early 2010s, base tax rate, additional assessment, and experience rates all went up pretty substantially and for a sustained period in that 2010s period. The pandemic was different, right? Because I think the policy recognition was nobody caused the, business owners did not cause the pandemic. So the 2022 session law removed pandemic-related layoffs and calculating an employer's experience rating going forward. That did save employers hundreds of millions of dollars a year coming out of that. And again, I think the recognition was the pandemic was a sui generis event, and it was a reasonable policy choice to make. The trust fund replenishment law also set the base rate to 0.1% and the additional assessment down to zero. Again, significant savings for employers at that time. But I think we are, you know, when we see where the UI rates are now, I think those choices, I think, did have some level of impact there. Whenever talking about UI, try to also put it in national context just to understand where we stack up. Minnesota really does rank in the middle of the pack in UI tax as a percentage of total wages. And nationwide, the percentage of total weight of UI taxes as a percentage of total wages was much higher coming out of the Great Recession, right? Minnesota was 0.73% back in 2015. We're only at, you know, we're at 0.44% right now. So, you know, I think, looking historically, UI taxes as a percentage of total wages are significantly lower than they were. And, you know, 2024 was pretty comparable to where we were in 2023 overall. Not a radical difference. Actually, I think our rank across the states dropped one in terms of that. And then I just have a table of just the total rates comparison on the last. I won't go through this, but I would, you know, I think I would look at the total rate range in that rightmost column because that's ultimately what an employer pays at the end of the day. Now, again, for most employers, the experience rate is the largest component, and that is directly tied to their experience with the program overall. But I did just want to provide some of that historic context so members have that available to them. And that's my presentation, Mr. Chair. I know you're on a tight timeline, so I wanted to keep happy to answer any questions.
Yeah, thank you very much, Deputy Commissioner. I appreciate that. We have one so far. I maybe have a couple questions. Representative Zalesnikar, to your question.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the presentation. I understand the experience rating. I understand the, you know, the base tax rate, those parts of it. My question is for the 14% increased assessment. I'm wondering if this fund, trust fund, was ever replenished by the legislators in recent history. Has there ever been a time when the legislators voted to replenish this trust fund?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zalesnikar, yes, that occurred in 2022. That's really the only time that has occurred. That did not happen during the Great Recession, but that did happen in 2022 coming out of the pandemic.
Representative, follow-up?
Yeah.
Yep.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for that. So in 2020, after 2022, then, there was still an additional need then for the 14%, if I'm understanding this graph right. And so this last increase fell on employers. So I guess my question is, there could have been a choice to use that $18.5 billion surplus to replenish the fund for this trust fund for unemployment. That could have been an option to do again, like was done in 22, if there was this significant gap. I guess I'm curious on that.
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. So, there were a few elements that made 2022 2022 was an historic low in terms of UI benefit payments. So, what we have seen as slide 8 shows, 2022 we actually saw a relatively low benefits usage coming out of the pandemic. I think there was, if you might remember, it was a few years ago, there was a bit of a phenomenon that I think only became clear in retrospect around, there was, in 2022, there was relatively little churn in the labor market. And as a result, there was, you know, nationwide, we saw relatively low benefits, relatively low benefit payments in UI that year. That's the year the legislature, you know, adopted the trust fund replenishment. Had the trends continued in had benefits kind of remained at the level that they were in 2022, it's possible, you know, it's possible that, you know, the trust fund balance would have been a bit higher and some of these sort of self-correcting mechanisms wouldn't have needed to be employed. that was not the case, right? And what we saw in 23 and 24 was growth, and again, this was not just Minnesota, this was nationwide, of overall UI benefit programs. And again, I think that's tied to some of the post-pandemic labor market churn. I am not a labor economist, so I don't know all the details there. But I think that's ultimately what I think that was one of the contributing factors that led to where we are today. But again, I think the trust fund replenishment bill passed in 2022. Additional things have occurred since 2022. And I think the good thing here is that the fund is designed to be self-correcting so that it'll be available for Minnesotans, when the next economic downturn hits.
So members, I've got four more people on the list. I'm going to move it on to Representative Wayne Johnson.
Thank you. I have two questions, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the presentation. First one is when was the special assessment at 14% previously, or is this the first time it's been this high?
Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Johnson. I don't believe so. I believe it was at that level coming out of the Great Recession.
Okay.
I'd have to double check. Follow-up
question was back in, because I was employing people back when COVID happened, I know you didn't really need to have a reason to file for unemployment. It was pretty much if you quit and you felt you weren't safe going into a home, whatever, you could file unemployment. And I know that happened just because you couldn't dispute anything. But basically at that time, too, they said employers would not be held, or their experience rate would not be held responsible. Is this now the back method of saying, okay, we are now holding employers responsible for the decisions that was made to allow people to take unemployment rate more freely because it did need to get paid for, and now employers are paying for that decision?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, pandemic era related layoffs were not and are not charged to employers, right? So that will not occur. What is occurring now is if an employer laid off an employee in 2023 or 2024, those costs do get reflected on an employer's experience rate. It's a rolling 4-year look back, right? So those components would have always been charged to an employer, and again, I would presume are. I would also just note, in terms of pandemic, there were a variety of pandemic-era unemployment programs that were, some of which were required by the federal government. So there was a lot that went on during that time. But again, I would say that the experience rates that employers are paying do not touch pandemic-era pieces. They only touch layoffs that would be at this point post-pandemic.
Representative Greenman, you're up. I've got 2 minutes, and I'm being asked because they're outside the door and you need to come in. So if we can wrap it up real quickly,
yeah. And
I promise we will have this again coming
Thank
up.
You,
okay?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I look forward to it. And
Thanks
I actually,
for your brevity.
Given
you.
That we don't have much time, I just wanted to respond to something that Representative Zalesnikar said, because in 2022, I was here when we passed that $2.7 billion tax cut for the biggest companies in Minnesota. The way that ended up working is 60% went to, because it was an employment-based cut, 60% went to the biggest companies that actually did very well in the pandemic, and that was PAC taxpayer funded out of the general fund. And so when we talk about why we are here and how the UI trust fund is accounting, it actually is based on decisions we made, freezing the experience rate and freezing the base rate at 0.1%. And that was a regressive way to do it. I think we should focus on small businesses. But the idea that we would this year spend general fund dollars or would have, to give big businesses tax breaks, is a bad idea.
Thank you, Representative, Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Chair. I know that we're just wrapping up. And, I'll just note that before that $2.7 billion, we had already made a series of decisions to exempt employers in ways that we never had before. Reminder that typically after a recession, the balance goes down, the rates go up, and we exempted employers from that for a number of years. And I understand this is just sort of getting back to where we were before. I know, Mr. Chair, that we're at we're hitting 10 a.m. I'll just note that we're going to have three bills up tomorrow.
Okay.
So we can get that part out of the way.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you so much. And just I had one more on the list, Representative Schultz.
it's probably too long for this, especially, but I'm looking at this, and what I'm most confused by is how usage of UI was higher in 23 and 24, while during that period of time, the unemployment rate in Minnesota was at 3% or beneath in both years. So I just have a hard time understanding that.
Next time, should we bring that up? Okay, we're gonna wrap it up just because out of respect for our other colleagues. Commissioner Rowe, thanks for coming forward and appreciate this. We'll have more conversations. Members, that concludes our agenda today. We are adjourned.